I apologize if some of these things were already covered. Just tell me. It's always my assumption when there's ethnic or presumptive ethnic violence in this East-West split that it's a response to economic and political confusion or turmoil. And so I guess I'm wondering what steps you would see that need to happen for things to settle down. I was wondering about Jose's position on all this stuff. I remember hearing him speak just after all of kind of East Timor was becoming independent, and I was surprised at how conciliatory he was with regard to Indonesia when there were still some really bad stuff happening in places that you guys were working on. But usually on ethnic stuff, he's very good. So I was interested in his position. And the third thing, Ramos Horta. I assumed that everybody knew who that was. Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. It's the Jose who we saw the most of here in the United States. And the third thing, and this is kind of tangential, but it's just something I've wondered about, was that when I was more active before independence and doing work on East Timor, I remember certain times the women whispering to me things like, domestic violence is really a huge problem in East Timor, and I'm interested in what progress has been made on that particular issue.
Last one first, domestic violence is still a huge problem in East Timor. If anything, it's worse than it was a few years ago. Economics is part of it, post-conflict is part of it, patriarchy is part of it. There's been some efforts to deal with it. Legally, there's actually a pretty good domestic violence law that was finally passed this year after many years of lobbying. The provisions in the Constitution about women's rights and domestic violence are reasonable. It takes the judges a while to catch up with the law, and some people accused or even convicted of pretty horrendous domestic crimes have been let off with very light sentences. Hopefully that will change, but it's a slow process. And I think attention to that issue and many other fundamental issues is going to be sidetracked by this current crisis. It's one of the consequences of this crisis. In terms of José Ramos Horta, I think his current role is problematic. Just to catch you up on the question, he's been the leading advocate, he and Shanana together have been the leading advocates for, I would call it amnesia, they would call it reconciliation about the crimes that Indonesia committed against East Timor. Maybe amnesia is too generous a word. He's been consistent on that for several years. And his rationalization for it, which has some validity, is that East Timor can't count on the international community to be consistent on this, and East Timor alone is too small and too weak to take on their huge Indonesian neighbor. And they've too many times been let down by international support, and so they can't take the lead on it. That's his excuse. And then he goes through and explains vote by vote in the Security Council why the UN isn't going to do anything without saying, but they should do something. That's sort of the left out sentence that we have to complete for him. But I think his role in the events of the last couple of months is, to me, very problematic. I spent a couple of hours talking with him the first week of May at his house. He came back from the Security Council meeting that was here in early May and was the first, really the only political leader in East Timor that was actively trying to talk to the different sides in the debate. And he was going out and talking with the mutinous soldiers and talking with the people from the West and talking with the people from the East. And he went to the border and talked with the people on both sides of the border with Indonesia. And he talked with Shanana, he talked with Akatiri. He was trying to play his sort of Nobel Peace Prize role, which was good. I mean, it was long overdue. Somebody should have been doing that months before, but he at least tried. But over the few weeks that followed after that, he seems to have pretty clearly aligned himself with the people who wanted to depose the prime minister. No, he resigned the day before he did. He's talked about as a likely candidate, but the only way he could be a candidate is if they tear up the Constitution, because Fredlund's never going to choose him. So he has a sort of problem now of, you know, since he's this Western-educated and Western-oriented person in his thinking, if he wants to follow constitutional processes, he's not going to be the prime minister. So his position now is, if everybody wants me to be the prime minister, I'm available. That's sort of what he said about UN Secretary General a few months ago. And he's not actively campaigning, at least publicly. But he was very actively in his press comments saying things like, if 10% of the accusations that have been made against Al-Khatiri were made against me, I'd resign out of self-respect. You know, that's the kind of stuff he said in the Australian media, you know, in the last week or two before the prime minister resigned. So I'm not quite sure what game he's playing right now.
Let me just say a little bit about the domestic violence thing. Well, before I came here to the United States in 2004, I worked for this organization as judicial system monitoring, and I fought a lot of cases in the court system about the domestic violence. And what happened is, like, as you know, we said, we still have, and as Charlie said, in any case, it's getting worse than it used to be, like, you know, 2-3 years ago. And one problem that triggered these domestic violence cases is that there is currently, I guess, there are like, we now have these, the Ministry of Justice have this plan where, like, they recruit judges from different countries, like from Sri Lanka, from others, and then, as we know, like in East Timor, there are only like most of the like one, what I could say, like a little bit active court is the Dili District Court, and we have like three other district courts, which is located in Bacau, the eastern part of the country. There's one in Okusi, and there's one in the western part, which is in Suai, but they do not really work because we don't have the personal capacity. We don't have enough lawyers, and even if they do, I guess the government has started to like translate, like, you know, to. It's pretty hard because they don't really have the capacity. Even if they do have the court buildings up there, but it doesn't really function. So, if you don't have court functioning court system, that itself will just worsen the current situations that we have. Say if you have a domestic violence case up there and there is no way they could bring up to the, you know, to the court, because there is no court out there, and even if there's court building, it's not functioning. And say, like, if a woman has been beaten up by her husband and she wanted to report it to the court, it's very difficult because we also live in this culture. You know, it's not simply because of the legal; it's also culture, the thing that, in a way, women are still regarded, more especially in very traditional, you know, like, or very, like, you know, suburb places, where they think that women should be, like, you know, should not have the equal status as men. And again, let's say, like, if something happened in, you know, like domestic violence cases happen in the district of the city, you know, of the capital city, it's very hard for them to come, because like their life is totally dependent on the man. Like, say they are not educated and the man has a job, man has the money, and if they're not given the money, how can they buy the transport, and, you know, how can they, you know, have the money to pay the transport and come all over there from the district to the capital? So if we see, like, in the city, in the capital city, where the main Dili District Court happened, like, you know, is established, they have, like, you will see a lot of domestic cases being reported to the court. But then if you go out to the courts in the districts, there are like few, or even like there could hardly be domestic case, you know, violence cases being reported because of the problems that we faced, like, you know, the culture, you know. And I personally, like, come from a place where I knew that there are like so many domestic violence cases happen, but they don't blame that it's a bad thing. They say it's a culture, you know, you're a woman, you're supposed to be as a Timorese human, you're supposed to be, you know, abide by whatever your man is say or your father is say, whatever. So I guess that's just a little thing that I want to share about the domestic violence thing.
I want to say a few things about this because I did a lot of work on it when I was in East Timor. And another obstacle for dealing with issues of domestic violence and violence against women is the issue of the non-functioning court system. A lot of times means that women go through traditional dispute resolution processes. And those processes currently are almost all dominated by men. The elders in the community, the male elders in the community. And quite often, even when a woman brings a case to this traditional process, she is doubly victimized. She's judged to be the responsible party in the dispute. So there is some work being done to try to open up that process a little bit and have a greater role for women in it. But currently, it is a system that also victimizes women.
Okay, I just want to add some more about what Manajil and Nino have said. I mean, this is, I just want to give an example, because I think last year, before I came to Hawaii, there's a case that one of the lady was beat by the priest in Same, and they bring the case to the court, but most of the Timorese people, they say that, oh, they blame a woman, not the priest. So there's no, the priest was released, acquitted. Because of our culture, so, I mean, the Timorese women still, I mean, they have to fight for this kind of domestic violence. So it's very hard for the Timorese woman right now. You want to add more?
I think part of Sharon's question was how the way forward from this ethnic or regional division. Does anybody have any thoughts?
I don't know if I will. I did capture the right question, but I probably just want to pick, there's one question coming up about the cycle. Probably there's a cycle of violence, like East Timor has bad temper or whatever. Well, I'm East Timorese, and I'm trying to say it from my own perspective. I guess Timorese can be like really calm, really patient at some time, but they can also be very violent and like very, very like tough-minded in special circumstances when they are being like over-provoked, you know, like. So what happened is, like, in a way, like, say, Timorese, like, you know, like, what happened is, like, now we have, like, the governments, you know, like, we have more division than those who have things and those who don't have things. Like, if you go to East Timor, especially, like, those of you who haven't been to Timor, like, you go to the capital city and you can just see that, wow, this is good, you know, there's, like, something going on. But as you stepped out from that city, you go to the district, there's, like, totally different. You just seem like you were in different country or different place, because everything is concentrated in Delhi. Whatever comes, like, the investments or, like, the business, the school, they all, like, concentrated in the capital city. So I guess the biggest problem that we have now is, like, you need, like, how we can decentralize all these things. How can government have different plan in order to channel whatever, you know, like, to channel like programs, whatever, through the districts, so that people in the district can also feel that they, at least they gain something out of the independence. Because I knew, because although I lived in Delhi since I finished high school, like, in 1999, I'm like from a like village, like a real remote village. And I knew, like, there are some people who haven't seen dollar, the US dollar, which has been used for like many, many years, like since 1999. And they still kept the Indonesian rupiah because they just don't have, I mean, how can people, because everything concentrated in the capital. You have the money coming out from, you know, like international community, from international organizations, but then they will all be invested, like, you know, in the city. They'll be there, and they will be taken out by the, as we said, the very earlier of the meeting, that most of the money will be going to, like, you know, to pay for the advisors and to pay for the international, you know, like, advisors who are being, like, sent there or whatever. So, like, the money goes there, and it stays a little bit in the capital, and then it comes back, and it never gets to or it hardly gets to the districts, or, like, even to the villages. And I knew, like, a lot of families who when you sell the dollar, it's like, oh, wow, is this the dollar? And I was like, yeah. And, like, so they have, like, a lot of money. They still have, they still kept the Indonesian rupiahs, because it just that things have been so much concentrated in Dili that they just don't know what's going on. So when it comes to, like, whether, like, you know, we do have the cycle of violence, it's like a normal person would be, like, so mad at that kind of situation. But, like, people, like, in the villages, they don't really care, you know. Even if they don't need to eat, like, you know, nice food, whatever, to go to eat in the restaurants, like, people in the city, they still eat, like, cassavas. They still eat, like, sweet potatoes. They don't really complain about it. Or at least they don't make, like, a big case as not, they don't go to the city and demo that, hey, why are you guys here? You go to, like, a bar and, you know, drink beer, and we're still up here in the village, and we're still doing it, like, we're still, like, eating what we have been eating, like, long, long time ago. They don't do that. That's how I characterize East Timorese, as they can be, like, very patient, and, you know, like, you know, very, very patient can anybody think about, but they can also be very violent when they just think that, oh, it's so overdone, I can't, like, stand this anymore. So I just don't think that there is a cycle of violence. It's just that there is this tendency that, you know, like, it's so hard, like, to say that there's a cycle of violence, because I personally don't think that East Timor is violent. But I do agree that, like, we do have this tendency where, like, if something happened, we are not happy with it. You burn houses, or, like, you, that's the bad thing. But it's not like we do it everything. Yeah, we do everything. Yeah, we do it, like, every time when we are not happy with any, you know, with what the government says. It happens maybe once in a while after we get, like, you know, after, like, people get so pissed. And maybe they've been incited by some other groups who want to take advantage of them too. So I guess I'm not sure if that there really is, like, a cycle of violence that's going on in the community. But, well, I can't say no totally. I can't say yes. But I just don't think that there really is a clear line between yes or no, that there is a cycle of violence or there is no cycle of violence.
Just two quick comments on what Nino said, which I agree with. One of the characteristics of post-traumatic stress syndrome is that people sometimes react violently to things that more together people wouldn't react violently to. In terms of Dili-centric, I mean, what he says is absolutely true about the economy being all focused in Dili, and it means that Dili's population tripled from 1999 until 2 months ago. Now it's sort of back to where it was before 1999, you know. And so when we hear there's 76,000 people from Dili that are IDPs in the districts, really they're people who've gone home, right? They've gone home temporarily. I mean, they presumably also have homes in Dili and will come back. I just want to tell a little story. When Jill and I went last year, we took some vacation time, and we were driving in a beautiful mountain up above Same, for people who know East Timor. Beautiful. And there was an old man there herding horses. He had about 10 horses in this fantastic scene. Actually, the scene, I took a picture of him with his horses, which my Timorese friend has as a wallpaper on her computer. Anyway, we started talking with him. He was about 70, maybe. And we're asking about his family. He says, yeah, he's got, I forget how many, but his kids are all in Dili, you know, and they're raising their families in Dili. And we asked him if he wants to go to Dili. He says, no, why would I want to go to Dili? I mean, he lives in this beautiful, he doesn't have a lot of money. I don't know, he doesn't have a big house, but he appreciates the beauty that we as tourists appreciate, and doesn't have the thing that the next generation has in a large extent, which is a result of Western exposure, I guess.
One last question.
our two last. Let's take two.
Buor tardi, dia kalai. That's about the extent of my Tetun. I spent 6 months in East Timor as part of UNTAYAT, and I left East Timor about a month and a half before independence, and it was a life-changing experience for me. And what I'm curious about, as a person who's not overly politically informed, but do follow somewhat what's happening in East Timor, what is the mood on the street like right now? What is it, hopeful? Is it very volatile? Is it hopeful one day and desperate the next day? What is the general feeling among just the regular people on the street in Dili and elsewhere?
I think I've been there more recently than anybody else here. The mood on the street in the end of May was anticipation and fear and mostly absence. I mean, there weren't a lot of people on the street, right? Most shops were closed. Most people were in IDP camps or out in the districts in Dili. In the rest of the country, I mean, I went out to Lorosai, this alien place, right, to Los Palos and Viqueque, third week in May. And things are pretty normal out there. Roads weren't fixed, but people had they went to their farms and they had their food and they went to the market and shops were open and, you know, life was like life is. I think your question is a little hard to answer, but I think part of the one of the contributing factors to the current crisis is that the bloom is off the rose of independence, that the expectations that people had that independence was going to make major changes in their life. Certainly in some ways it did, right? People don't get tortured and murdered and things like they used to. But in terms of economic development, it's a lot slower than what many people had hoped. And I think now people are sort of reaching the end of their patience, and some of what's happening now is people are acting out of frustration that hasn't developed.
East Timor is a country who just experienced post-colonial kind of, just have their post-conflict country. Certainly have also try to compare East Timor with others. Sometimes your home is different from other people's home, then I think you would like your house to be and that as well. And I think we are also trapped by the idea of developmentalism. Sometimes people say that, well, there is no development if there is no new house, brick house built. And I think people are also, apart from what Charlie said, at high expectation of that as well. Sometimes people, women in East Timor, some people say, we want to have a kind of very fashionable, we want to follow fashion because they read. Yeah. I know because I have also some women friends. they read a lot of news. Pop magazines from Indonesia and said, "Well, we about this. We like this." Kind of, and they watch films from Indonesian TVs. So, yeah. There are also problem of economic, but also of mentality. And because of that, one is because of comparing East Timor, which is kind of a country in the third millennium, to Indonesia, which is kind of which reached its independence in 60s or 60 years before that. And I think that's a little bit troublesome as well.
I guess it's 5 years since East Timor became independent. I speak as a person who also came from a colonized country. One of the very surprising thing that I found when I heard about East Timor is how quickly it went from a colonized or occupied country, because occupation of 25 years is also an occupation of many 100 years from colonization. And that very quickly there was a constitution that appeared, which which seems very much that, you know, from my perspective, didn't look like it came from the people. It was chosen by probably an elite of people who had been educated among Western, you know, ways, but not something that followed a particular process which comes when people become independent. They typically have a period of fashioning something that is more, that comes more from their own traditions and the way they have, you know, governed themselves. So there was the perception that we came from a tabula rasa where there was really nothing, and all of a sudden there was this miracle government, Western style, electoral, winner-take-all, very, very Western system. And now I hear from the conversations that there are people, you know, in the country, and then there are people in the cities, there are people in the cities more comfortable with the Western type of government where you elect people periodically, you know, sort of at-large type elections, where the people in the country who had the system, which I hear they were, you know, more traditional chieftain type, elders, consensus, participatory type. So perhaps the question is the perspective. Is there something that is missing here that the Timorese, do they feel that they are represented? And I'm not just asking the people of the city. Overall, the question is, is there a bad direction? Because, you know, it's competitive, it's electoral, and somebody is in power and decides whatever they want and just ignores everybody else. If the Timorese really had it for themselves without outside influence to have their own form of government, would they choose this form of government, which is basically elections and prime ministers and presidents? And
many people believe that East Timor was the UN, I mean, success story. And people believe that because our turning kind of overwhelming to, I mean, also our struggle to against Indonesia, that is very influential in Asia, was marvelous. It set a good example. And when UN was there, UN had such good, I mean, success story. Apart from failure, their failure in many countries, in Cambodia, in many countries. So East Timor was, I mean, a kind of believed to be model of many things. So having not only president, but prime minister was a kind of, oh, this is a good model. I mean, and a good example that in, well, this is a lesson also for Indonesia, our neighbor. Muslim, being a kind of Muslim in a majority, kind of Christian, to be prime minister, well, this is also an example, at least for Indonesia. I mean, well, it was saying that, well, Indonesia was our past history, though the division was not clear because we saw, so we have to start new. And I think that at a certain point, we wanted to experiment, and now we are having problem with our kind of experimentation. I have to say that. But well, we are learning, and I think I do hope, and I do believe that we also learn from this as well. It's not because. There are kind of many models created, and I don't know which models, but at a certain point, I also believe that some people create models, and we have to fit into that, and when we don't fit, people say, oh, you're different, and because you're different, you don't deserve, or you don't merit our confidence, and so on, but, well, I think that happened also in East Timor.
Just a quick comment. I can't say whether the Timorese people would have chosen the kind of constitution that they have if they had been given a free choice. But what I can say is the process was very rushed. In the United States, it was 8 years from when the U.S. won the revolution until the constitution was adopted. In East Timor, they had 6 months, basically, from when the Constitutional Assembly was elected until it was supposed to write the constitution. And it asked for and got a couple of months extension, so it ended up with a little bit more than 6 months. But actually, no, they were elected in August, and they finished the Constitution in March. So what's that, 7 months? And the main force behind it was that U.S., France, Australia, and other U.N. countries wanted to get out. And their definition of being able to get out was they've had elections, they've had a constitutional government, okay, they're independent, bye, good luck. And I think what the U.N. has recognized now is, and even Australia, even the U.S. have recognized this, they got out too fast, and that process was too rushed. What we, and we in this case, I'm talking about Lahamutuk, the East Timorese NGO that I work with and that I used to work with, just wrote a memo to the UN, which people can get on our website if you want it, which basically says, yes, you need to go back and try to get it right the second time, but if you just go back and do the same things you did before, you're not going to solve the problems, and that these are specific things that they need to do differently. And one of which is recognizing that nation building, for lack of a better word, takes time.
I guess, yeah, I mean, pretty much, like, whether we could have chosen, like, this form of government that we have today, if we have not been influenced, or we have not been, like, you know, told, or, like, you know, whatever. I don't know, because, like, again, whatever form that we would be choosing, it would be based on what we have experienced. Say, like, we have been under oppression so much, like, you know, from different occupations and oppressions, all this. So it may not be like the same forms that we have today, but it will be something that will be designed in a way that we don't want those things happen to us anymore. But I guess even with the current forms, we still, I think we could have done more. I mean, the current government could have done more in a way that, because I was monitoring the constitutional development when it was drafted, and what happened was that, yeah, again, one factor was that the timing, it was rushed. But at the same time, when the constitution, the draft constitution was brought down to the community, and which was meant to be consulted with the community, whether what they want, what they like, and to accommodate what people say, instead of, like, accumulating people's ideas, the party at that time that brought down the constitution to the people, they appear to be very defensive instead of, like, accumulative. So, like, probably if we, I mean, things changes, but as I said, maybe we could have, maybe if we have, we could have been done different if only, you know, most of the things that people say to the draft constitution were, like, were taken, because basically, the first draft constitution that was brought down was the same one that was then ratified. But at the same time, there were, like, a lot of main points that was raised in the same same over and over again in many different districts, which was never like included, because every time when somebody's saying the same thing, like, in one place, there is always going to be, like, a defensive argument from the member of the constitution at that time. So I don't know, it's just, I think maybe we'll be a little bit different today, but at that time, I followed the constitution development, and there were, like, people asking about, oh, whether we should add about, like, say, the age of children, like, a kid that could be regarded as, like, you know, 18 years old, when can one be considered as juvenile, or we should definitely define it, because I was working on this working group about, like, you know, children's rights. So we mobilize, you know, people in the district on how they need to protect the rights of the children. But then we have, every time when this issue was raised, the member of the constitution would say that, hey, you know, like, it's not, we are not, like, living in the United States. Here you can say, in the East Timor, we can say somebody's 6 years old, but he might have the capacity to kill other people, and you couldn't just let it go. Those kind of, like, argument, it just, to me, it was just, I don't think it could make any sense. I mean, like, my problem was not, like, about, like, the age just to be defined, but how important it is for us to, like, to have a special protection for the children, that they cannot be manipulated, they shouldn't be going through what their parents went through, you know, in the past years. But then again, you have these very defensive people who will just say, oh, you know, instead of, like, saying, okay, we'll think about it, we'll see, like, whether, you know, many people think about it same way as you do, they will say, they will give you, like, a response, defensive response, and which will dismiss your contribution, there was also issues, you know, like language. They want why it's Portuguese. You know, there were like a lot of, you know, different consultation. A lot of like young people that said, "Hey, Portuguese was no different than Indonesia. They're all like occupiers, you know, whatever." But those weren't like make any change. And then like there were also like religion. And hey, how can you say this? You know, only say little thing on the preamble about the religion when we knew that, you know, Catholic Church had played very important role in the struggle, whatever. It's not like I'm agreeing that that should be in or out, but like if you have to go by majority, then I knew that majority of people were thinking about that, but there weren't any changes coming to it. So I don't know, probably that could have been like more, a little bit different if only the member of the Constituent Assembly at that time may have been like accumulative instead of like defensive, I guess.
Well, I just want to add some more. From my point of view, I think when they prepared the constitution, I mean, there was no enough consultation with the Timorese people. So, I mean, even some of the members of the parliament, they didn't speak Portuguese, and some of them, they don't really understand about the constitution itself. And also, I think there's also no enough socialization about the constitution to the Timorese people. So, I mean, it's just like, I don't understand. I mean, from my point of view, it's just like Charlie said, that it was in rush, so that they tried to put everything, make sure that before the UN left, they have done everything. So, I mean, this is one of the results that happen now, that people don't really understand about their own constitution. For instance, there was like the national anthem. Timorese people don't really know, and they don't, I mean, there is no clear about the national anthem. The student, they don't, I mean, there is no like lyrics or text of the national anthem that Timorese people can to sing the national anthem, because everything is just not really clear. So, I mean, yeah, that's my point, because of for me, it's just like there was no enough consultation with the Timorese people.
I think we'll wrap up. Thank you all for coming. Thanks to our panelists. And do some shopping, and we're not in a rush to get out of the room, so if people want to talk after, that's fine. Thanks.